Hi, Bomb Squad. Welcome to The Future of Food, a Radio Cherry Bomb miniseries. I'm your host, Carrie Diamond. The Cherry Bomb team toured America last year and traveled from Atlanta to Detroit to Portland and lots of places in between to ask women what the future of food means to them. Throughout this series, you're going to hear talks and panels that we recorded on each stop. You'll hear from chefs, journalists, activists, bakers, and even a drinking coach. These members of the Bomb Squad share their vision for what's next in their world and the world around them. I hope this series inspires you to stop and think about your future. Thank you to Kerrygold for supporting our tour and this mini-series. Kerrygold is the iconic Irish brand known for its award-winning butter and cheese made with milk from grass-fed cows. For this episode, we're traveling to Seattle, Washington. Our event was held at Book Larder, the wonderful cookbook store owned and operated by Laura Hamilton. We're going to kick things off with a talk about cookbooks and community by Deborah Balint, an Instagram cookbook club pioneer. Before we get the show on the road, let's check in with our sponsor. I don't know about you, but when I think about the future of food, there's definitely cheese in it. You know what I've never known is how cheese is made. I got a chance to talk with Sarah Furno, a farmhouse cheesemaker based in Ireland, whose family created the delicious Kerrygold Cashel Blue Irish farmhouse cheese. Here's Sarah telling us a little bit about the process.
Well, it all starts with the milk.
And the milk that Sarah uses comes from the cows on her family farm. What makes this milk so special?
We're very lucky in Ireland. We've got a very mild climate, so our cows are out on grass for most of the year. And why is that important to making cheese? Well, I know that the flavour palate that gives our cheese is particularly sweet and creamy.
But milk is only the first part of cheesemaking. Later in the show, Sarah will tell us more about how her incredible Kerrygold Cashel Blue Irish farmhouse cheese is created. Want to give Kerrygold a try? Visit KerrygoldUSA.com to find out where you can buy their award-winning pure Irish butter, salted or unsalted, of course, or their iconic Dubliner cheese. That's KerrygoldUSA.com. Let's welcome Deborah Balint.
Thank you. The future of food is online cookbook clubs. Cookbooks and local neighborhood cookbook clubs, of course, have been really popular because they're fun and people get to try new things. With social media and the internet, over the last couple years, we've seen a rise in online cookbook clubs. So I'm Deborah Balint, and I'm Rainy Day Bites on Instagram. And several years ago, I started the first online cookbook club on Instagram. At that time, there was no others. And I had noticed going through my feed, I saw people posting photos of, you know, getting together at their local neighborhood cookbook clubs. And I thought, gosh, that would be so much fun. I would totally love to do it. But none of them were close by, and the timing never worked. And I sat there and I thought, you know, this is something I really want to do. There has got to be other people out there like me that, for whatever reason, they can't attend one in person too, but they still want to join in. They still want to do it. So the lesson in that is, if there's a community that you need and it's not out there, create it. Because at the end of the day, there's going to be other people like you that have that same need. So that's how I started the online cookbook club. At this point, I've featured 57 monthly selections. The group has made a total of, we're just over 6,100 recipes. And, you know, it's there's something about if you're cooking from the same book at the same time, using the same recipes, you create a shared experience. And what happens with that shared experience is you end up building community. You form friendships and you end up having a network of people who are supportive. They're getting you inspired to create other things from the book, to challenge yourself, to try new cuisines or new techniques that you thought, oh gosh, I could never do this. I've never attempted, you know, this pastry before. But suddenly, you know, I've put it out there as a challenge recipe and said, I've never done this either. Let's do it. You know, we're all in this together sort of thing. And you form a support group of people with that too, because everyone's discussing strengths, weaknesses of recipes, they're asking for help, and it just ends up creating this great community of people all doing the same thing at the same time. You know, at the end of the day, you do it because it's fun, and it's when you do it from online, you end up having people from all over the world who are joining together with a similar passion for cooking and a love for cookbooks. So that's pretty much it. I hope you guys join one.
Thank you to Deborah Balint of Rainy Day Bites for getting so many people to cook and to share what they create. Our next speakers are Carrie Brunson and Autumn Martin of Frankie and Joe's, the plant-based ice cream company. Let's hear what the future of food means for them.
I'm Autumn Martin, co-owner of Frankie and Joe's.
And I'm Carrie Brunson, also co-owner of Frankie and Joe's.
Yeah.
And we're really excited to be here in front of everyone and talk a little bit about what we believe is the future of food.
We have a plant-based ice cream company here in Seattle, two shops, one in Capitol Hill and one in Ballard. We opened our first shop in 2016, just a couple weeks ago, 2016 actually. We just had our second birthday. Frankie and Joe's was really built around the desire to create a vegan ice cream, a high-quality vegan ice cream, because we really felt that there is a need to have a shop dedicated to ice cream made from alternative milk sources.
So a little bit about our backgrounds. I got into food in a very interesting way. I have a background as a professional dancer and entered into the food world and decided to start a juice bar at the farmer's market and turn that into a cafe called Juice Box. And that opened in 2012. So now we're basically grandma in restaurant years. And then Autumn.
So I started Hot Cakes in 2008 at the farmer's market. So we just had our 10-year anniversary.
Woo-hoo.
Yeah, super exciting.
Oh, she's a great grandma in restaurant years.
Gray hair to prove it, let me tell you. We're an interesting duo. I come from the pastry world. I've been a pastry chef, chocolatier for almost 20 years now. And Carrie, being a former ballerina, worked her way into the natural restaurant sect, I would say, from kind of getting tired of like the unhealthiness of
the restaurant industry. Yeah.
So started a juice company, which has morphed into a Juice Box Cafe. Yeah. So our two backgrounds just go hand in hand with Frankie and Joe's, where we are producing an ice cream made from, as I said earlier, alternative milk. So when we talk about future of food, as I'm sure every single person in this room probably knows, it's a huge can of worms, right? You can't just talk about one thing that we want to see change in the future of food. Every issue is dependent on the other issue having some kind of spotlight on it and some attention paid to it. It's very holistic. We need to think about it from a holistic perspective. But we're kind of chipping away at the issue of using animals for our food source. And as we move forward, more humans are being born every single day. That's not going to change. We know that. And so how do we feed our traditions and how do we nurture ourselves through animals and do that in a sustainable way? So in my mind and in our mind and in Frankie and Joe's, we really want to work on creating these like uber traditional foods that we love and that are so important in our family and in our culture, using plant-based ingredients, and not only plant-based, but ingredients that are really clean too, because you probably know like the plant-based industry can be kind of laden with chemicals and gums, emulsifiers, and you know, these processed foods that are made to mimic these animal foods. So we're really trying to make a traditional food that's really important in our culture with clean plant-based ingredients.
Yeah. All plant-based food, all vegan food is not created equal. It does not equal healthy or clean, et cetera. It's just like food that isn't vegan or plant-based. So
yeah. So,
I mean, I can talk about clean ingredients. I mean, that's something that's actually very important to me. I feel like when I think of the future of food and the plant-based food movement and plants in general, it is not just it's not just about, oh, well, this is vegan, therefore it equals X. And our customers actually are telling us how important it is that we are transparent and that we are being very intentional about everything that we put into our ice cream as well. And as a consumer myself, I'm also sort of doing that same thing. I have recently overhauled my whole beauty program. The things that I drink, natural wine, the food that I eat, I always am looking at the label and I'm like, why did they put that in there? I don't think I'm going to purchase that. Because I don't know what that is. Like, why do I have to Google search it? And so we have spent time and energy trying to create our products without the use of anything that you wouldn't be able, you don't have to Google search what's in our ice cream. And that is something that is very important to us. And I do believe is the future, just as a consumer myself, knowing what I see, what our customers are telling us. And what's amazing as a business owner is that without our customers, we don't have a business. And ultimately, they are telling us what it is that they are wanting to see. So
it's a challenge.
It's a challenge.
Yeah, it's a challenge.
Daily
we have
challenge.
To change the way that we think. And
changing people's minds it takes a lot of energy, and we're ready for doing it. We're ready to do it.
Yes. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks to Autumn and Carrie for telling their story and for putting such a great product into the world. We visited Frankie and Joe's when we were in town and were blown away. My favorite flavors, the brown sugar vanilla and California Cabin. Before we get to the panel, let's return to our adventures in cheesemaking with Kerrygold. Earlier, we heard from the farmhouse cheesemaker Sarah Furno about the first steps in the cheesemaking process for Kerrygold Cashel Blue Irish Farmhouse Cheese. That first step, getting great milk. But what comes next?
It's a fermented product, cheese, so you have to add in, you have to start the fermentation process. Initially, when we did this, we used to just work with homemade yogurt, so it's called the starter to acidify the milk. You can sour it. There's lots of different ways of doing it. And then you also have to add in a coagulant to separate the fats and the proteins. We work with vegetarian rennet. It's a plant-based rennet.
Once all the ingredients are in, you and your cheese are in for the long haul with days of turning, shaping, and separating.
And then we have to let the blue mold develop for a number of weeks. And then we wrap it and we keep on turning it. And then it takes another 3.5 months before it develops its full flavor and character. So it's a long, long process. Cheese is not made in a day. I always say it's the cheese is the sum of its parts.
And trust us, those parts are delicious. Want to try Kerrygold Cashel Blue Irish Farmhouse Cheese or the savory sliced cheddar cheese for yourself? Visit KerrygoldUSA.com to find a store near you. That's KerrygoldUSA.com. Welcome back. We wanted to spend extra time in Seattle so we could visit some of the incredible female-owned food businesses we hear about back in New York. We crammed in as much as we could before and after our panel, who you're about to hear from. At the end of the show, I'll share some of the places we visited. But first, let's welcome Linda Dershang of the Dershang Restaurant Group, Chef Emmy Ribeiro Collins of Alcove Restaurant, Linda Miller Nicholson, a.k.a. Salty Seattle, the innovative pasta artist, and Molly Moon of Molly Moon's Homemade Ice Cream. When you hear the term the future of food, what is it that comes to mind? So, Molly,
You have the unfortunate position of being right next to me, so I'm going to ask you first.
Wait, okay. I just want to say something to podcast land. I am living in the future right now because I am pumping breast milk with my robot boobs, I call them. So I'm sorry if they make a little bit of noise into the microphone.
So you're doing that right now?
Yes.
I am so impressed.
I would unzip my jumper if you wanted to see.
Yeah.
Speaking of alternative milks.
It does it for you? It just...
I am wearing pumps. I'll show you later.
Okay, but wait. You're going to turn this into ice cream, right?
See? No. This is for my baby daughter. I do make breast milk popsicles. Yeah. We'll go into that later.
That's the future right there.
When I think of the future of food, I think of a couple things. I think of how you have to eat food with people that you love, and how as the world becomes stranger and technology advances, something that will stay the same is having dinner with your parents if you're a kid, or with your kids if you're a parent, or your best girlfriends forever, and that it's something that no matter how scary or strange the future is, there's something about eating and food that will stay the same, and that's really comforting to me. And another thing I think about the future of food is, you know, I think the future is female. And you're right. There are not a lot of women building empires like Linda is. And I have always considered her a huge role model and went to her when I was writing my business plan and hope that there are more women in ownership and that the working landscape in food as a server or in the kitchen is more fair to women. And I think we have a ways to go in all of those areas, and I think that the future is brighter.
Linda? We vote, and we're very fortunate to be able to vote. And especially in this country, we have accessibility to that, and most of us have had that accessibility for about 100 years now. I see the future being more conscientiousness toward voting with our pocketbooks. You vote once a year or in your primaries on a piece of paper, and a lot of people see that as a hugely empowering step. Some people see it as futility. Every single day, we vote with how we spend our dollars. And I would like to really think about the fact that throughout our lifetimes, we can make a huge impact with how we spend our hard-earned money. And so if I'm thinking about what the future looks like and how we can truly affect change, that, I think, is the number one thing that we have the actual, literal, tangible power to do to make certain that something like actual corn is available in 10 years from now, you know, and Monsanto/Bayer hasn't just completely, you know, ruined the taste of it. Make sure that we seek out those products that we think are truly important with regards to what we want to eat, who we want to support, and who we want to empower, which the future is female.
Amen.
Okay, so the future of food. I think of two things. More plant-based diets, people eating less meat. I definitely feel it's going that way, and I hope that it is for the environment, for our health. But also as a woman in the restaurant business, I definitely hope to see more women in the business, and in the business of food. So whether it would be in growing food, producing food, or owning businesses around food, but also owning restaurants as chefs, as managers in restaurants. The more women that we have in leadership positions, the more women they're going to be able to, the more women that they will hire and be able to mentor and bring up. So that's what I would like to see happen.
When I think of the future of food and the future in this industry, to me, the future is diversity. And when I say diversity, obviously, as the previous lady said, more women in the industry, more people of color, and not just with your staff diversity, with your clientele, making sure that your business is accessible to a large group of people. And obviously, diversity in food. I'm Brazilian. My parents have owned a Brazilian restaurant for almost 20 years. And I think that there's a lot of like underrepresented like cuisines and culinaries from all over the world that really deserve to be more prevalent.
Emmy, tell us about your family. How did they come to open a Brazilian restaurant in Seattle?
Yeah, so my mom has always been a cook. Back in Brazil, I moved to Seattle when I was 6 years old. Back in Brazil, she owned a catering company. So it was just, it was a part of our lives forever. So when we came to Seattle, my mom was, you know, the cook of the Brazilian community. She would always be cooking for gatherings. And then it kind of went into the Seattle community. She started cooking for caterings and things like that. And some people just believed in her and helped her open a restaurant, which kind of in turn helped me take over and be able to be in the position to have this restaurant now, because if they hadn't believed in her, I probably wouldn't have this restaurant right now. So.
And did you work in the restaurant when you were younger?
I did. So the restaurant opened when I was 12, and I loved like busing, hosting, like whatever it was, like I wanted to be in there. I worked as a server for a long time at my parents' restaurant and other restaurants in Seattle. I always thought I was going to be in like the front of the house service. Just I love people, love talking to people, but my love was culinary and cooking. So that's kind of where it got.
How did you transition into the kitchen?
Master Chef came to town in 2010, which me and Linda.
Don't point at me.
Me and Linda. I won't say which one of the Lindas. So I was a server at the time. Master Chef came. It was like for amateur cooks, and I made it. Me and Linda made it to like LA.
Talk we about did. Bro culture.
I exactly. And I don't know why that made me want to join the culinary industry, but
because we wanted.
But
to
surprisingly,
turn it
yeah, right, exactly true. So when he was kicking me out, Mr. Ramsey was like, "You should go to culinary school. There's something there," you know, which I'm sure was probably all like scripted, but like, I was like, you know what? I actually should. And when I came back to Seattle, I literally enrolled into culinary school. So I went to culinary school because of Gordon Ramsay. Funny story. But yeah, so I went to Seattle Culinary Academy and yeah, just started working at Mom Noon here in Seattle, a couple other restaurants. And then I have a 10-year-old, a 3, and a 2-year-old.
You have three kids?
Oh, I have three kids. Wow.
Good job, Mom.
Although I was never able to breastfeed. And then I was a private chef for a really long time. But then I kind of missed like cooking for the community. So, yeah.
So did you do a Kickstarter?
I did do a Kickstarter for the restaurant. Yeah, so my parents' restaurant was in not the greatest shape. I don't know if anybody ever visited Tempero do Brasil. It was really like hole in the wall, like little Brazilian restaurant for 20 years. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted something to look nicer, like, but I didn't have the money, the capital to. And as you know, for women to get capital, for women of color to get capital is really hard. So thank God for Kickstarters and all these new like ways to be able to get capital for your business, because yeah, it really helped me out a lot.
And now it's called Alcove.
It's called Alcove, which is English, but it's like Afro-Brazilian, inspired by the Pacific Northwest. I think I had a couple names. I had some names in Portuguese, but everybody just liked Alcove. And to me, like, I'm Brazilian American. I, like I said, I came here when I was 6, so I'm okay with an American English name.
Thank you for being here. What a tremendous story.
Thank you.
So, all right, going back to Molly now. So Molly, like I said, when we were at your original shop this afternoon, you had this fantastic poster about all these things that have happened over the past 10 years of Molly Moon. And one of them talked about employees and how you have health insurance and dental and vision and paid time off and all these things. And I was just like, oh my God, how do you do this? You have a seasonal business, and obviously that's the future. I mean, we can't, you know, restaurants can't continue the way they are. Like, everybody really needs a living wage, needs to be paid better. We need to figure out the tipping situation. So I'd love to hear a little bit about how the heck you do it.
Well, thank you for all those sweet compliments. Before I started Molly Moons, I was a political activist. So it is in my blood sort of to do the most political thing in any situation I'm in. So when I wrote a business plan, I was actually hoping to start a business that did the most true to my political values things. And it has all been really a grand experiment. Will it work if I give everyone health insurance that they don't pay for? Will it work if everything's compostable? Will it work if I buy from local farmers? I don't know. Let's see. And it really, really worked when I started my first shop in 2008. And Seattle was incredibly supportive of the first sort of homemade ice cream with all these values that matched, I think, most of my customers' values up front, shouting about it. And I think that's how we can do it. And, you know, I started with the values of I want everyone to have health insurance who works 18 hours a week or more, and I don't want them to pay a dime for it. And I want everything to be compostable because the planet, and we'll just figure that out. And there was a third thing. Oh, I want to buy from small local farms direct, and I don't want to have distributors, and I don't want to buy things from far away. Everything's going to be as local as possible. Now, there are some caveats like chocolate and tea and coffee, and all those things will be organic and fair trade or direct trade. So those were sort of my three pillars in the beginning. And I was able to be really loud about those. My customers supported that. And we were super successful in the first few years with those. And then I just started adding on things, other things that I believe in. So pretty soon we started having paid family leave. And now everybody that works at Molly Moons, even a scooper, gets 12 weeks of 100% paid family leave when they bring a child into their home.
Do you just sell a boatload of ice cream every day? Like, I'm just like...
We do sell a lot of ice cream. And we're layering things on. And one of the biggest and most interesting challenges is the pay structure in restaurants, right? And how it's so fueled by tips. And so that's something that I started tackling when I was very active in the committee to pass the Seattle minimum wage law. And even though that has had very huge negative impacts to my personal bottom line and to the business's bottom line, I'm still here and we're still here and we're making it work.
So one thing we always tell people when we make all these stops is like, vote with your pocketbook, and you should all have a favorite female chef, and you should all know what businesses in your neighborhood are female owned, female run, female fueled, and support the hell out of them. So tell us some of your favorites and what you do to support
them.
I'll
absolutely do that. The interesting thing, when Cherry Bomb first was a glint in your eye, I heard about Cherry Bomb through a woke man. His name was John Rowley. Probably a lot of people in this room know who he is. He's a food guru. He brought us oysters. He pretty much hoisted Tailored Shellfish to the forefront. He brought Copper River salmon to the lower 48. It was a real pioneer. He passed away last year. But he texts me. John Rowley can't like text really, but he fumbled text me. He's like, have you heard about this magazine? It's the most amazing thing ever. Ruth is part of it. Oh, you know.
Ruth Reichel. Yeah.
And Linda, you got to get in. These people are amazing, you know. And he was such a champion of Cherry Bomb. And he is such a empowered for a man in his 70s at the time, you know, to see this as the future and to know that he was ushering in. And for 40 years, he ushered in these new generations, you know, of a very empowered people, not necessarily women, but people in all walks of life. It's very cool to see something thrive that that this person who could, he used to take a refractometer to the grocery store, which is a thing that measures the sugar in things, and he had no shame in just plunging his refractometer into peaches at QFC. And then, excuse me, where is the produce manager? You're selling these? You're selling these peaches? No, you can't sell these. Have you heard of Frog Hollow Farms? So John brought you to me. And so I actually do, just on a very slight separate note, think that if we're relying on other people for the future, you know, absolutely it's female, but who we kind of want to help us lead this charge is woke men. I was talking to a friend of mine the other day, and he was like, I got man spread on the subway. He's like, I know what you mean now. I know what you mean. It's very uncomfortable. Yeah, it is. It really is very uncomfortable. So I do want to give a little bit of a shout out to the awesome woke men out there. Maybe there's a few in the crowd.
And absolutely,
here.
The guys who are here, this is a pretty high percentage for us. Yeah. So thank you. to the, how many, four? I see four of you. I counted him in my, he's in my count. But no, thank you. We've actually had events that were 100% women, so I appreciate that the four of you are here. So, oh, Matthew, five.
In terms of women-owned businesses, I do think being sort of like a fledgling women-owned entrepreneur, it's really scary sometimes. You know, you wake up and you think like, can I do this? Like, how am I doing this? And there are people among us who did it a while ago before it was easy. You know, I feel like 25 years ago, there was this master skeleton key that got passed down from bro to bro, you know, and you never really got handed that key. And if you wanted it, you sort of like had to claw through and grasp onto it yourself. Now we're very fortunate to live in sort of this like advent of the post-internet era where a lot of us have the, you know, smart key embedded right here. You just have to figure out how to use those biometrics. And it's really interesting to think that we can, you know, truly figure out what it is that makes us uniquely who, you know, we are, and then use that skill set to create an amazing business.
There were no women to go to. I had trouble having beer delivered to Linda's Tavern the first 2 weeks we were open. They didn't want to sell me beer. They would deliver a keg at a time, one case of beer, of different varieties of beer, and I was calling every day saying, I need more beer. I need more beer. Please bring me more beer. And I thought, you know, in paying cash, that was the way it worked. You were writing a check. It wasn't on terms. You weren't using a credit card. And beer doesn't go bad. So if they sell me too much beer, what's going to happen? And I'd been in retail before, and often people were saying, are you sure you only need a dozen? Don't you need two or three dozen of this or that? So it was really odd. And I was asking other men that owned bars, are you having the same problem? Will they not sell you beer? No, they were not having that problem. And it was about probably the third week we were open, and these reps, I called them the high five and white guys because they were all these bro-y guys, reps. Right? Yeah. And they were sort of sports guys, right? And they just kept saying, well, why are you so busy? I don't know. But once we're a popular place, I don't know. Why? I mean, how are you supposed to answer that? Because a woman owns it? What's the surprise? So anyway, by the third week, I guess they realized that it was a good account to have, and they started taking care of us. And Linda, what do you need? Linda, can we bring you more? Linda, do you want to put another one of our handles on? And it all really changed. And you know, at the time, I just kept moving forward, and I didn't dwell on the fact that I was having to basically beg to buy beer from these guys. It was years later that I started really thinking about what that was. I mean, I really did just kind of get past that and just move forward. And it was, yeah, years later, I started telling people about the beginning of my career. And as I repeated that story, and people would look at me, well, especially women, but men too, wide-eyed, like, what? I still don't exactly understand why they were doing it, but maybe, I don't know. Anybody have an idea? Because it seems really strange to me if they are salespeople. Right. So, and that was in 1994. There weren't any other women I knew in the industry to ask if they were experiencing the same thing. I didn't know any other women that owned bars. So it was quite a few years later that I started. And it wasn't, you know, sometimes people said, well, were you just not reaching out? No, there weren't any other women to reach out to. There were some women that worked in bars, but even then, there weren't that many women that were bartending. You know, there were maybe a woman who was a bookkeeper somewhere. And it's definitely really changed, thank God. But especially over the last 10 years, I've started having a lot more friends, women friends in business. I mean, look at what's going on in our city, you know. But, you know, many are quite a bit younger than I am. And I'm so grateful to have so many because it's been a game changer to be able to call women, go to, you know, and get advice from different women, but call them and say, I'm dealing with this. Are you? Have you dealt with it before? And I know some, like, you know, Molly came to me early on asking for advice, but, you know, it really shifted with a number of women, you know, Carrie, also Rachel from Rachel's Ginger Beer, into just exchanging information rather than them coming to me for advice.
Because sometimes being a mentor is a difficult position to be put into because you don't necessarily have the same experience or, you know, it was a different sort of culture.
Mm-hmm.
How do you... I'm
running with questions.
You notice she didn't want to answer the question, but keep going.
When people come to you from a mentorship capacity, how do you handle that, and how do you answer specific use cases?
Molly can answer.
Linda is amazing. She is such a good advice giver, and she is so giving to other women. And I have been the benefactor of her advice for 11 years. But she's also very busy, and she is a one-woman show. She has so much on her shoulders, and she handles like 7 different groups of investors, and just it's incredible what she does. But the first time I met with Linda, I showed her my spreadsheets of like my startup business plan. We were at a coffee shop at Bauhaus. Whoa, aww. Sad. And we were there, and she was totally into it. She was like, have you thought of this? Have you thought of this? You need to put a line here. This is too much. You know, have you thought of this? She was so awesome. And then all of a sudden she looks up and she was like, oh my gosh, I've given you an hour and a half. I have to go. And she like left the coffee shop.
I call that my ADD blurt.
I didn't care. I still followed up, and she still gave me advice.
And I was having a lot of fun, and I do enjoy the number side of things, actually. You know, and then Molly has also, you know, as she's grown in her business, I mean, the relationship changed very quickly into discussing how we were, how we were handling certain landlords. We share one landlord.
More women landlords. More women property owners.
Yes. Women, yeah. Women attorneys,
All right, we're going to go to the next question that I think all of you got in advance, and we're going to do a little bit of a speed round because I think some of you might have questions for the panel. But I ask them to look forward 10 years to the year 2028 and tell us where they think they will be, their business will be, et cetera, even if it's sitting on a beach. So, Molly, 10 years from now.
In 10 years, I will have a 15-year-old daughter and a 10-year-old daughter. And that's what I thought of first. And a 20-year-old business. And I hope to own, this is so silly, but I love it. I really want to own a Hawaiian coffee farm on the Big Island and spend half of my time there. I don't know how I'll do that with kids in school, but I'll figure it out. And be spending a lot of time writing and speaking to other women who are starting businesses.
Oh my gosh, I love all that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Linda?
I would like to continue to make the aspirational achievable. So a lot of people come to me and they say, your career seems so crazy. Where do I check the box for that on the college applications? Mm-hmm. And you can't check a box. And I think the answer is put in a lot of work, put in the 10,000 hours in terms of finding your passion and truly sticking with it, and then continuing to sort of spread joy. It's amazing to work in food. Food is the great common equalizer, and bringing people together is something that we need in this effed up, gosh darn world. Shout out to me for not effing that up. So I'd like to continue to do that on sort of a global trajectory, really understanding that we live in a global society and not as much of a local one anymore, and truly bringing people together over food in a way that's something that they thought previously wasn't possible with sorcery, is in fact something that they can do in their own kitchen using ingredients that come from plants that they grow in their yard and chickens and ducks that poop them out of their butts every day.
Awesome. Linda?
So I've never had even a 1-year plan. My life has been kind of free flowing. And so 10 years is, that's a big one. I will also be 70 in 10 years. And
what?
So, Yeah. So, and I know I don't want to retire, but I don't want to work the way that I worked in my 30s, 40s, and 50s. And so I'm really looking at, you know, that transition into still working and being part of my company, but also empowering the people that I work with. And some have been with me for a really long time to really take charge of a lot with our company and keep the company going and succeeding and doing what we're doing. But if I could be away about half the year, and I'm working towards that, I love being in New York, but also just traveling. And I'm building a house in the Yucatan with a friend in a little town. So I would imagine that we will probably spend some time there. So that's the best answer I can give, because who knows what I will be doing in 10 years.
Thank you. I hope that in 10 years, Alcove is 10 years old. I hope that I am able to have other restaurants. Pretty much, I hope I'm Linda Dersheng in 10 years. That's what I want to be. I want to be Linda in 10 years. Yeah, very inspirational. You, Renee, other women in Seattle. That's where I want to be in 10 years. I'm only 30, so I think I can do that in 10 years, you know?
That's a great goal, Emmy. The Renee that Emmy mentioned is Chef Renee Erickson, who has incredible restaurants and bars in the city, including the Whale Winds, which we were fortunate to visit. Our other stops, Rachel's Ginger Beer, Molly Moon's Homemade Ice Cream, Carrie Brunson's Juice Box, where we had the best savory oatmeal, Linda Dershang's Odd Fellows Cafe and Queen City, and Chef Rachel Yang's Trove, for really inventive noodles, kimchi, and dumplings. The Cherry Bomb team and I can't wait to go back to Seattle. Our show was produced by Jess Seidman and supported by Kerrygold. Thank you to our Seattle host, Laura Hamilton of Booklarder. If you love cookbooks, and who in the Bomb Squad doesn't, go visit Booklarder. Thank you to all of our speakers, to Matthew Amster Burton of the Spilled Milk podcast, who recorded our event, and to the amazing members of the Bomb Squad, who joined us for this taping. Thank you for listening to the Future of Food miniseries. Here's to a delicious tomorrow.